That was a nice warm-up, that 45 minutes of sitting in more ways than one. While I was sitting tonight, a bunch of different stray thoughts were converging. And first I was just appreciating so much the blessing of sitting, the blessing of sitting here with you, the blessing of you being able to sit together as a group, the sacred power that that ensues when people come together in this way. And and really I was reminded that we, at least I think I can speak for all of us, I don't think we can do compassion. We can't become compassionate. I think compassion flows naturally from a relaxed sense of being, from a sense of ease, from a heart that has been soothed by our own self-love and appreciation, by a recovering, a rediscovery of a basic goodness, basic okayness, that quite naturally when we're free for a time from our preoccupation with our own internal drama, when we direct loving attention to our bodies and minds in this way, it's then that quite naturally we feel a sense of inner sufficiency and fullness, and then are available, open to each other in a loving and compassionate way. It's not something you can do, because as long as there is the doer of compassion, even so-called compassionate acts, there is still suffering, there's still tension. So it's the open secret, as I often like to speak about, the open secret that is pointed to in all wisdom traditions, is the rediscovery that the very nurturing, the very relief that any of us needs, and at heart of the Buddha's teaching, heart of the teachings, the experiment of the teachings, is that everything can be discovered and realized in this present moment. That truly there is only this present moment. There is only this, as Alan Watts would say, only this eternal now. It is this living reality that we share with every being who has ever lived, every being who will ever live. It's where we all meet, this animated reality called life. Not my life or your life or so-and-so, but life itself. And it seems that when each of us, in our own way, in our imagined selves, plugs in to, realigns with this life, rediscovers this sense of immediacy, there is a vitality that arises, there is a soothing and a resting, there is a capacity to find an unshakable refuge, an unconditioned happiness that has never been, unconditioned meaning it's never been created, nor can it be destroyed, and is only found in the present moment. And in fact, this present moment. So I say this, remind us all of this open secret that says, don't lift out of this moment to find relief, no matter where or how far you wander. This relief is only a split second, a half breath away. So I say this, and then thoughts emerge again. The thoughts that most of us have, as most of you have probably heard before, the 65,000 thoughts that you had today that were mostly, or 90%, repeats from the day before. These 65 thoughts ensue. And a lot of these thoughts are thoughts of self, thoughts of the meditator, thoughts of the spiritual practitioner, thoughts of the material seeker, the psychological seeker, whatever that seeker might be, these 65,000 thoughts emerge, and in a very flash of a moment of non-awareness, we take birth as the one who is not quite okay, who will then become okay in time. All of this is in our mind, of course. There's no evidence for it right here and now, the not okayness part, unless we consult memories or plans. And then you hear these teachings. And some of the teachings that have been most impactful for me and most inspiring, but at the same time most hypnotic, and these are the ones I want to talk about for a few moments, have been both the teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the teachings on happiness, the happiness of the Buddha. I know at past times that I've come here, I've talked about the Buddha being called Sukhiya, or the happy one, and have described that the happiness of the Buddha is not ordinary happiness. It's a special kind of happiness. It's the happiness of the unconditioned, the happiness of a happiness that is free of hunger, a happiness that is not dependent on how things are going in my life. It's a thread of okayness no matter what's happening. And this is contrasted to worldly happiness, called Lokiya Sukha, happiness of the world, which is the happiness that depends on satisfying a hunger, depends on getting what you want or getting rid of what you don't want. And it's this kind of happiness that cannot be denied because there's lots of pleasure in this world. It's this kind of happiness that is under the domain of what the Buddha called dukkha, a happiness that will not give lasting satisfaction. But this is the happiness where most of us live. And so in hearing these teachings, I said, oh my God, the Buddha started with the happiness of sense pleasures. I figured that's all I have, is the happiness of sense pleasures. And then in the life of the Buddha and in the life of the meditator, one moves on from the happiness of ordinary sense pleasures to the happiness of more refined sense pleasures, the satisfying of that hunger for a mind and heart that is unified, is whole momentarily, and an initial taste of what he called a supramundane, a beyond the mundane kind of happiness that he called samadhi, or a mind that is composed and collected and absorbed in an object or in the breath or whatever it might be, in such a way that well-being, that satisfaction is sustained for long periods of time. The happiness of a heart that is at rest for a long period of time. But the Buddha discovered that even those most rarefied states of mind that one enters into, eventually will pass away. And so even that kind of happiness is still worldly happiness. It's the happiness that is dependent on conditions being just right, your mind being in a certain right way, and it lasts quite a long time, so it's better than the original stuff, but still not reliable. And then, of course, the Buddha went on, and he started paying attention to his mind, practicing vipassana, and he discovered vipassana happiness. And vipassana happiness was the first glimpse, the first taste of a happiness that didn't depend on what was going on, which means a happiness of seeing the arising and passing of a certain experience and having the heart not move toward or away from it. And so there was a realization that, wow, there's a certain delight, he called the joy of equanimity. There's a certain delight at experiencing pain and pleasure and seeing that none of them last, none of them are graspable, and they're just happening all by themselves. Seeing the three characteristics, which I'm sure many of you are experts at. So then, of course, following this vipassana happiness, this glimpse of freedom, the Buddha stopped looking for happiness in worldly ways and trying to satisfy a hunger. And when his mind withdrew from its normal preoccupations, experienced the nature of all things that can be noticed by our different senses, that they all come and they go, and unreliable, and they're empty of self, they just seem to do themselves. When he realized that, his mind relaxed, stopped grasping, stopped pushing away, and his mind enfolded on itself. I'm sure you've heard many different renditions of this, but his mind stopped searching elsewhere and turned on itself. And in a flash of knowing, in a flash of insight, the Buddha realized that the very inexhaustible resource that he'd been searching for, the very reliable refuge that he'd been looking for, was none other than his own present wakefulness, the nature of his own mind. And in that he discovered, in his path, he discovered the happiness that is unconditioned, and a deep sense of that. So you hear these teachings on happiness, and it sounds inspiring how the Buddha practiced for 6 years, and he went through all this arduous practice, and he went through all these experiences, and finally he realized his nature. And I know for me, I thought, well, maybe someday that'll happen to me. And the truth is, over 30 years of practicing meditation, spending probably more than 3 years of my life in silence, periods of 3 and 4 months at a time, I've had all kinds of exotic experiences, a lot of what the Buddha described. But nevertheless, I was hypnotized by this sense of the path, the teachings, being something that starts now and goes to some imagined time in the future. And there's something very compelling about that view that I'm not there now and I'll be there somewhere else, some other time. And I began to think the same exact way about the Four Noble Truths. I knew that someday, you know, you read the sutras on the Four Noble Truths, and they talk about the, you know, in all the different numbered sutras, they talk about the three elements of the four truths, or the 12 parts that you need to notice. And I'll go through them briefly. Hope this doesn't drive you crazy. Lists were good when the teachings were just oral, you know. Now you can, everybody's experts because you can just pick up the book at home. But anyway, the first truth, there is suffering. This must be understood. You know, the Buddha said that this is the most important thing. You've got to understand suffering, otherwise your life is an endless running from it, and you'll just be caught on that flywheel of waiting and hoping and trying to get somewhere else. So there is suffering. This is the first thing. This must be understood, number two. And then one has to be able to say, this has been understood. One has to be able to make that lion's roar, this has been understood. Second, there is a cause of suffering. Number four, this must be abandoned. You've heard this before, right? There's a cause of suffering, this must be abandoned. And then one has to be able to say, this has been abandoned. And then next, there is an end to suffering. There is a cessation of suffering. This must be realized. And then the lion's roar is, this has been realized. And then last but not least, there is a path to the end of suffering. You need to know that path. This must be cultivated or experienced or followed, practiced. And then one has to say, this has been cultivated. So doesn't that sound like a long journey? At least it did for me, and it did for a long time. And what dawned on me recently, and what has been a great joy in a way, almost a greater joy than any of the exotic experiences I had in long practice periods and any of the steps on the progress of insight that came clear to me on a retreat. What has been most enlightening recently has been to see how the Four Noble Truths, and this may seem so simple, so ridiculously simple, how the Four Noble Truths can be examined, investigated, experimented with, and realized on the spot. That you don't have to wait 25 lifetimes or till you've sat for 30 years or done how many retreats or been in silence for so much time. But if these teachings are true, they have to be able to be discovered, whether they're true or not, in the only place that we live, the only place that anyone has ever lived, which is here and now. So, I'll just tell you a few, I'll confess a little delusion. I was driving along with my wife on one of the streets, the main streets of Mill Valley, California, the heart of Marin County, where it was a Sunday and the population was having their perfect Marin County day. Sun, tennis, sex, tubs, food, whatever it was. And my wife and I, driving into Mill Valley on our way for our Marin County hike, happened to come up behind a very shiny bluish-purple Porsche with a perfect, I'm going to get in trouble for doing this, a perfect Marin County couple who had their visors on and their sweaters wrapped elegantly around their shoulders. And it would have been enough to just describe my immediate judgment about these people. But what added insult to injury to myself, I realized, was that they were also going extremely slow, oblivious to, it's seemingly oblivious to anyone else on the road. But what really got my attention was the attitude that I had. What the attitude about who these people are and who they should be and what they should do. And it became very clear to me. Any of you have attitudes when you drive? Okay. Good, I'm glad makes me feel better. It became clear that there was suffering. I was suffering. I had incarnated, I had taken birth as the sufferer. First noble truth. This has been understood, experienced. There was the cause of suffering when this suffering met the light of awareness, came into view. There was the cause of suffering. The Buddha said the cause of suffering is craving. Craving for sense pleasures, something more pleasurable than what's happening. Craving for becoming, craving for existence. Trying to, you know, make myself better or make a situation better. All in some ways, a state of waiting, hoping, expecting. And it was clear that this was this cause of suffering was a clinging or craving. And in this case, it was clinging to the view, to a view that had the effect of making me take birth as the one who was waiting to be happy. A view that this person should be different than the way they are. And we do it in all sorts of ways. I do it a lot of times. I should be different than the way I am, and then I take birth as the one who's becoming better. We do this every day, all day, and this is what most of our internal dialogue is. So this was a revelation in the moment. There's suffering. There's the cause of suffering, craving. Craving for this person. And then there was the thought that came, because there was awareness that met this situation, it's not necessary to hold this view of this person. And there was just the experience then, there was still the residue of that contraction, that feeling in my heart that things should be different than the way they are, that these people should get off the road and change their wardrobe and drive an older car or whatever. There was the recognition of this, but there was the residue in the body. And in letting that meet the light of awareness, there was a melting away of whatever idea was going on, whatever tension in the body. There was a cessation of suffering. There was, in that moment, a direct experience of the end of suffering. I don't know about 30 years from now. I don't know about the end of this lifetime or 20 lifetimes. But I do know, and the only place that I can verify whether or not these teachings are true, whether the Four Noble Truths are true, is here and now. So there was suffering. There was the cause of it. There was the cessation of it. And in the fact that I had practiced in that moment, whether it came by itself or whether it was deliberate, because it had met the light of awareness, I had cultivated the Eightfold Path, or I had cultivated the path of awareness. So I had followed the Four Noble Truths, and I realized that they're true on the spot. And actually, the relief I felt was so extraordinary. It seems so simple. And then, of course, the next week, I got the ante was upped a little bit. My family came to visit. And I have certain family members that I have held, I have experienced suffering in association with them. Any of you relate to that? And I have held very strong views. The way I have coagulated myself had taken birth, had believed that I was somebody separate, partly was around certain views I have had of my family, of members of my family, with a very strong conviction that they should be different than the way they are, which inevitably puts me in a state of craving or waiting, hoping, expecting, postponing my happiness to the imagined future. And it became so obvious to me that there was who was suffering here? I was suffering. And I got even a, and again, this may seem obvious, I got a clearer sense that I was actually a lot of what was perhaps influencing their suffering as well. That holding someone in a particular view, which holding myself or another in a particular view, actually made my interactions with them not open, not loving, not compassionate. Again, my narrow, preoccupied state of mind, unable to really feel that open relaxation, letting go, and love and compassion. So recognized the first noble truth. There was suffering. There was the cause of suffering, holding to this perception, these views that kept me in a state of becoming, state of craving. There was the realization, don't have to be holding these views of this family member. There was the cessation of this suffering, instantaneously when meeting the light of awareness. How long it lasted, doesn't matter. As soon as we worry about how long it's going to last, we're incarnating as the one who's waiting again. We're postponing. We're looking to some imagined time ahead. But there was a cessation of the suffering. There was a relaxing of the heart, an opening to love and compassion toward my family members, which is, at times, has been rare with certain family members. And there was the path to the end of suffering. This experience had met the light of awareness. Awareness was being practiced. So right thought that was motivated by non-greed, non-hatred, non-ignorance, loving kindness prevailed. I was not causing harm by paying attention to the suffering, the cause of it, the end of it. And so I was cultivating the Eightfold Path, and the Four Noble Truths revealed themselves again to be true. So I was heartened and re-inspired that this open secret, that the end of suffering is now, that one should not for a moment, if you can, not for a moment step out of this moment, out of this instant, to find that relief, to find the Four Noble Truths, to find the happiness, worldly happiness or otherworldly or unconditioned happiness, that everything is now. And I know I've been, every time I've come down here, I've probably harped on this point again and again. Some of you I've seen, many of you I've seen before. But I've noticed again and again that I cannot, for the life of me, when I'm truly present with what's happening, when I'm not imagining myself to be present, not thinking of myself as the present one, when I'm simply present, not giving rise to an idea of the past or the future, when there's a bare open attention to how things are, seeing it how it is, I just cannot find any suffering. You know, once I have come to attention and realized when there was suffering, when what was causing it, what was ending it, and just hanging out in present awareness, that it's become clearer and clearer that this present awareness is the very inexhaustible resource that each of us longs so desperately to have, and that the very thing we're searching for is here. So any questions, comments? Please.
Do you feel you'd be able to get through it, you know, with your family so easily, say if somebody was super abusive in the situation you were, you know, with them?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I would say I can only imagine, because I haven't had that experience, but I could say that I would certainly be aware of the suffering, and I might be able to distinguish the cause of suffering. I can't resolve somebody else's Four Noble Truths. I can only resolve them. I could see how part of the way I was reacting or how I dealt with the situation could be increasing my sense of suffering. And that can be in the form of fear, it can be in the form of hatred, it could be in the form of planning my revenge, all the things that would put me in a state of becoming, put me in a state of craving. Instead, if I was present, I would feel the suffering, and in a sense that might cut the chain that would make me incarnate as the one who's going to be the one to, you know, to fix the situation, and then be able to really respond. And that response may be to stop somebody or to scream or to do whatever I do, but it might not be, there might not be the suffering in it. So it's possible, I think, even in the midst of intense physical pain or highly charged situations, to step off of that wheel of suffering for oneself. And then perhaps, and I think this is really where the wisdom meets compassion, then I can actually respond in a more loving way. Because the interesting thing is that every moment that I return to awareness, just the state of awareness, not I'm being aware, but just the state of knowing, that instant itself is lokutara sukha. It's the happiness of the unconditioned. As soon as I'm the one who's in the state of the unconditioned, I'm conditioned again. I've stepped on that, what the Buddha called avijja. I've stepped into the world of ignorance, the whole story of me. But in that instant of noticing, even a difficult situation, I'm off the wheel. And the show happens, the world happens, everything in it, but I remain in that non-personal knowing in a way. And that's really what we are, fundamentally. The sense of the knower is a story we tell ourselves. But knowing is completely natural to us. Wakefulness. Uncontrived, unconditioned, unprompted. It's just presence. Each of us. Please.
Well, I really like what you're saying, and I don't think I've heard that very much.
Which part?
But I noticed that you aren't using the word enlightenment. And it seems to me that...
I'll call it, you can call those moments enlightenment.
Yeah.
It's definitely...
Moments of enlightenment.
Yes.
And I think that it's good for us to hear that that our practice is working now, and that these moments of awareness are what we're after.
Yeah.
And because we have them now doesn't mean that we always are going to be able to reach that state.
Well,
it's very wonderful that we can have them now.
That's right. But when you say the word reach that state, there's a tendency to think that you have to go somewhere ahead. And so the realization of enlightenment or present awareness being now is that you simply need to relax. You need to luxuriate. You need to nurture. You need to be where you are, be as you are. And that's not even what the spiritual teachings tend to engender in our minds. They tend to create a slightly toppling forward feeling that reinforces the view that we're not there and that we have to reach something. It's what happens when you don't reach anything, when you don't look ahead and you don't look back. It's too close. I mean, it's too easy to be believed. The Tibetans talk about the four faults. I think I may have even mentioned that the last time I was here. They say this freedom, this enlightenment. We'll use any number of words. It doesn't matter. Words are, even though they're loaded. But they say something. It's too easy for us to believe that all we have to simply do is to be present. It's too wondrous. It's too vast. Our wakefulness, it doesn't fit into our limited ways of viewing ourselves, because that openness is comprehensive. It's too easy, too vast, too wondrous. There's one more. Anybody know the list? Too close. That's it. There's a tendency to think it's far away, and what's important is that we keep referring to our present wakefulness. Please.
I like what you're saying too, and I think what about the natural way that human beings have of wanting to become, to learn, to strive to evolve. So where is that with just sort of like, oh, this is fine, just as it is now. I think there's something in between.
Did everyone hear the question? What about that natural urge to become, to learn, to grow? I think all of that happens even more powerfully when we're open, when we're not busy becoming. When we're not tense becoming, when we're not the one who's becoming, when we're simply allowing ourselves to unfold. Allowing ourselves to see what we love, and then to move, to see clearly what we're doing in our lives. Whether it's, when I'm more awake, I see, oh, that causes suffering, that causes more happiness. That I can see for myself what's a wise use of my energy. And when I'm not preoccupied with myself, when I'm not thinking about myself so much, and I would say that I think a lot about a lot of things, but there are a lot more. I think over 30 years, and again, we can talk about time because we all, we all live in time, on one hand. We all live in the timeless, too. But in 30 years, still have thoughts, still have sensations, still have all kinds of moods, but there are long periods now where my mind's really quiet. And there, I'm just present. I'm not thinking about myself. I'm not working on myself. And yet, and it seems like out of that, comes a lot more buoyancy, a lot more joyousness, a lot more interest, a lot more passion. Everything comes out of that. And so it may sound like a kind of laissez-faire, but I think the result of really trusting awareness and really seeing how it is in each moment actually is the application of interest and learning, but without necessarily incarnating as the learner and then having to become better. Somehow there's a difference. Please.
It's been said that the natural state of the mind is bliss and all that good stuff. There's a lot of books written on how to deal with everyday problems, and things come up and we go through suffering, and you know your story about the Uba Marin and so forth. My dilemma is that I think the human condition, is our minds hang on to stuff that happened in the third grade or could be the third century. You know, stuff that we hang on to and don't release. A lot of it we're not even aware of. And I think that's what keeps us from being in that really high state. So the real, you know, the $64 billion question is how do we clean that stuff out in a reasonable length of time? I sit in a cave for 40 years. And
well, the very nature of your question, recreates the sense that there's something to do, some place to go, or some place to go back to, or something to get rid of, and what present awareness accomplishes. And again, every teaching that was ever given by the Buddha was meant to be experimented with on present evidence. You know, when he would address the nuns and the monks, he would say, to be discovered here and now. Over and over he said that. Not adopting any views about what you have to clean up or what you don't. That's psychology. But really seeing the fact of what you experience, and again, you talk about those third grade, you know, associations or memories and the pain that you feel in the body. It's on present evidence, experiencing that, whatever that is, feeling the suffering of it, feeling the cause of suffering, like wanting to be loved or wanting something, feeling the end of suffering by just allowing that to come and to go. The cessation of suffering is just seeing the arising and passing of things on the spot. And in that, you've walked the Eightfold Path. That's all you can really know is that moment. Then, when you see for yourself, have confidence that whatever arises passes away, even if it re-arises again 1,000 times, that whatever arises passes away, that it happens all by itself, it's out of anyone's control or will or wish, that it is, there's not one feeling that you can have that'll give you lasting satisfaction. When you know that for yourself, then the need to dig up and get rid of and clean out all that stuff so you can avoid having to sit in a cave for 40 years, the need to do that vanishes. But the increasing I'll say for myself, what I've seen is the necessity to stay vigilant, to stay present, to keep cultivating present wakefulness all the time, because it's precisely that capacity to be present, even if it's experiencing the same thing for the 500th time, it's that capacity to be present that allows me to rest in that happiness that is not conditioned, and then it's okay whether that feeling comes or it doesn't come.
I think the awakeness is part of the picture, but I don't think the whole thing. I know someone who has reached that state. It took him 5 years of really hard work. But he didn't get into that blissful state either. He didn't get a lot of psychic powers, which he thought he was going to get.
Well, I don't think I don't think we need to worry about the blissful state and then set up that as another goal, or the psychic powers or anything, but to really see the teachings in their simplicity. And I think that the whole construct that you just presented is partly what keeps hypnotizing our minds into thinking of the end of suffering as being something so terribly exotic. It's really as simple as being present and at home with yourself. Really at home, in a state of ease. Not looking forward, not looking back. And then the capacity to then plan well, remember difficult things, remember pleasant things. Plan trips, plan jobs, plan education, but from a place of rest, knowing that you don't have to leave this moment to find the Buddha, that you are the Buddha. Again, it's too close, too simple. I mean, too close, too easy, too wondrous, too vast. That we tend not to believe that it's right here and now. Last question.
I just want
comment.
To clarify what you're saying, make sure I understand. Are you saying that the sensations, the anger, the grief, whatever these suffering things that we're experiencing are still there when you become present for a moment, say? But you're just relating to them differently. You're not caught, so to speak. It's still going on in your body. It's
kind
the
of
same sensation, the same yearning.
In a general way, you can say, as Swami Satchidananda says, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. Come meditate with Swami Satchidananda. The waves of past experience, the waves of karma, you could say, what we experience in the present moment is the result of what we've thought and practiced and experienced in the past. That's what arises for us. And what we experience as a future is what we actually do now. So what we set in motion now. So it's inevitable that even if we've established a great strength of present awareness and we've gotten used to our natural being and we're generally happy, that we will still experience the waves of habit. We're conditioned. You could say that what we are is conditioning in terms of our manifestation. So that's everything is bound to happen, but depending on how what we do with the thoughts of the past, thoughts of ourselves, all the memories, the associations, the feelings, the sensations in the body, because our bodies have formed around those past experiences as well. It's what we do with that as it arises that either creates more samsara, more wandering and waiting, or step off the wheel and be free in the minute, in the moment. So exactly what you said is right, as far as I can tell. Now, in a way, when you do become aware of what's happening, let's say there's something going on, in a sense, and again, this is something you have to experiment with, you're actually seeing what just happened the previous moment. But don't believe me. So we have to call it a day. So in my new discovery of the Four Noble Truths and the happiness of the Buddha being, the happiness of the unconditioned being here and now, I discovered new meaning in this wonderful poem from a Tibetan master named Gendun Rinpoche. It's called Free and Easy. So perhaps you can listen considering what we just talked about. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or to undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all, has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become attached to it, passing judgment upon it and ourselves? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing and manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching. or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or place, it is always available and accompanies you every instant. Don't believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They are like today's ephemeral weather, like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, comfortable. So make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further. Don't go into the tangled jungle looking for the great awakened elephant who's already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Nothing to do or to undo. Nothing to force. Nothing to want. And nothing missing. Emaho, marvelous. Everything happens by itself. So let's just consider for a few moments that if there's been any benefit to us gathering in this way, that we appreciate, as one is able to appreciate in silence, that between our ideas, that we don't really exist apart from each other until we think. But in realizing that, we can consider that whatever we've done tonight has benefit, may have benefit to beings everywhere, including ourselves. And let's just radiate blessing. That all beings can be free of sorrow and the causes of sorrow. That all beings can recognize the sacred happiness beyond sorrow. That all beings can have peace and contentment, be safe and protected, healthy and strong, and that all beings everywhere can live their lives with ease. May all beings be free of suffering. Could you hit the gong? Anyway, thank you all for your attention. Sorry I went over. Thanks in advance for your generosity. Don't get to thank you usually after hours.